88.1 in Fresno.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 7th, 2018. This is Up Front. I'm Brian Edwards-Tieker.
And I'm Kat Brooks. And on the first half of the show with Mitch Deseret, we're going to talk about Trump saying, what do you say, bring on the shutdown over immigration talks. Also, will he fire and or talk to Robert Mueller? And a look at what happened at Oakland City Council last night.
I like the, it's like the Schrodinger interview. Will he fire him or talk to him when they both go into the room? In the second half of the hour, we are going to talk apocalypse. The changes to the U.S. nuclear posture review that were rolled out Friday when Washington announces all good news. It's a change in the circumstances under the which the United States says it is prepared to use nuclear weapons, including in case of specific types of cyber attacks. Then in the final hour, the program will stand the nuclear theme. It's an hour-long interview with Pentagon Papers whistleblower and former nuclear strategic planner Daniel Ellsberg. That's all coming up next.
After the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. The deadline for another stopgap spending bill runs out tomorrow night. Lawmakers say they are on track to avoid a repeat of last month's government shutdown, though President Donald Trump unexpectedly raised that possibility if he doesn't get his way on immigration.
If we don't change the legislation, if we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13, there are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of.
Trump's comments were disconnected from progress on Capitol Hill. The House passed a short-term spending measure last night on a largely party-line vote of 245 to 182. Senate leaders are closing in on a larger, long-term pact. The broader agreement would award large spending increases to both the Pentagon and domestic federal programs, as well as approve overdue disaster relief. Democratic leaders have dropped the strategy of using the funding fight to extract concessions on immigration, specifically on seeking extended protection for the young undocumented immigrants brought to this country as children. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly threw fuel on the dispute as he defended Trump's proposed solution. The retired general noted the White House proposal would expand protection to include 1.8 million people, far more than the 690,000 who currently have DACA protections. Kelly said Trump's proposal would include some people who were, quote, too lazy to sign up previously.
There are 690,000 official DACA registrants, and the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number, to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 million were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up.
Democrats challenged Kelly on his too lazy slur. Senate Democratic leader Dick Durbin of Illinois, the party's chief immigration negotiator, added, quote, "It doesn't surprise me from General Kelly." Kelly is known as a hardliner on immigration. The White House says Donald Trump was just joking when he said Democrats may have been guilty of treason for not applauding during his State of the Union address. White House spokesman Hogan Gidley said the remark was tongue-in-cheek, but added that, quote, "What's serious is it seems as though the Democrats put their personal hatred for this president over their desires to see this country succeed," Gidley said. Arizona Republican Jeff Flake took to the Senate floor to say accusations of treason are not a joking matter.
"I have seen the president's most ardent defenders use the now weary argument that the president's comments were meant as a joke. Just sarcasm. Only tongue in cheek. But treason is not a punchline, Mr. President. We must recognize that this is aberrant, destructive behavior, whatever rationale its defenders may offer."
Arizona Republican Jeff Flake. Donald Trump has asked the Pentagon to plan a grand parade of the armed forces in Washington this year to celebrate U.S. military strength. The Washington Post first reported Trump's January request. It quoted an unidentified military official as saying the marching orders were, "I want a parade like the one in France." Trump was on hand for France's Bastille Day military parade when he visited Paris last July. Voters in San Francisco and Alameda County may face ballot measures to fund child care. In San Francisco, proponents turned in 17,000 signatures, well more than what's needed to qualify their measure for the June ballot. Supervisors Norman Yee and Jane Kim proposed a measure that would establish a child care fund by raising the commercial rent tax to 3.8%. They say the fund would clear San Francisco's 1,600 names long wait list for early education spaces, provide subsidized care for low and middle class families, and raise the wages of early child care professionals. In Alameda County, the Board of Supervisors voted on a June ballot measure to raise over $140 million to fund child care and increase pay to child care workers to $15 an hour. The measure would be funded by a half-cent sales tax. Supervisors President Wilma Chan.
This is going to be a historic day for Alameda County by giving our workers who work so hard with our kids decent wages, by coming close to eliminating the waiting lists, and by keeping our community diverse and healthy.
More than 115,000 Alameda County children lack access to formal child care and early education. Delise Monroe is a representative for Parent Voices of Oakland.
I have been homeless with my children, and I know the seriousness of having child care. Without child care, you really can't do anything. If you are a single parent and you're trying to make ends meet and provide for your children, you cannot do it without child care.
According to the 2015 California Child Care Portfolio, 69% of Alameda County children with working parents did not have access to licensed early child care. New airstrikes launched by Russian and Syrian government forces on a besieged rebel-held region east of Damascus killed at least 8 people, according to opposition activists. The airstrikes on eastern Ghouta have killed dozens of civilians in the past few days. The punishing campaign by Russia in Syria also has battered the northwestern province of Idlib. A hospital official in Idlib stood among the ruins of his facility. The remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
The third airstrike was the most intense. It destroyed the entire hospital. I'm sorry to say that we've lost a huge medical institution serving the entire area. I have no alternative. Everyone is asking me where to go. I have no answer.
The children's organization Save the Children said in a statement, the escalation in fighting in the opposition-held enclave of Idlib is placing thousands of children in extreme danger. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny, continued warm with highs in the mid-70s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy morning fog, then sunny and hazy, high 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 7:30.
Just about 7:09 in the morning, you are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Good morning, Kat Brooks.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Ms. Jesuit.
Good morning, gang.
Bringing you in right away, wow. Nice and early, acknowledging your presence in the studio.
Nice.
Hi.
Well, so, okay, now what do we say?
Now you talk
really
about...
thrown me off.
Talk about the... Now you talk about the shutdown and bringing on the shutdown and let's have a shutdown.
What Donald Trump said yesterday?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was better than the soundbite we were considering playing.
Right on.
I think we're going to go with dramatic reenactments from now on.
That's why we have an actress on the team.
You want to play Trump?
Sure, why not? Broaden my range.
Wow. we're going to be like Saturday Night Live here. Well, yeah. So it's interesting that he said that. And I'm not entirely sure what context he made it in or how closely he's actually following what's happening on Capitol Hill, because and again, the government would shut down if a spending bill what we always talk about, a continuing resolution to keep spending at where it has been. If something like that does not pass by the end of tomorrow, the government would shut down on Friday. Word is that they are close, Republican and Democratic congressional leaders are close to a deal. And this is interesting because, A, the deal will not include anything concerning immigration. And we could talk about what that means in the future moving forward. But it does mean that they would first, what they're considering is that they would first pass another continuing resolution that would just give them enough time to then pass what they call an omnibus bill. And what omnibus bill means is basically a bill that will fund almost all the entire government. In other words, most of the departments. That's usually how it works. And in fact, it would be a two-year budget bill. So it's possible that if they actually are able to pull this off in time, that we wouldn't be talking about another government shutdown because of this for another 2 years, which would be pretty remarkable considering we're now doing it, what, every other week or every 3 weeks, certainly every month now.
About as often as I get bikes stolen.
Yeah, well, no, I think that's a little more frequent. It's now down to 17 days between, so well, it's pretty close, actually, to this last one. That's true. We could start, that's right, it could be our measuring stick of when the government's about to shut down again. That's when Brian's bike gets stolen.
Oh.
Sorry about that, Brian. Just so everyone knows, Brian had his bike stolen again yesterday.
Second time in 17 days.
At least I didn't have that much time to get attached.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. And, at least this time they left your lock behind.
That's right,
so you can
claim
see
the
what
insurance
happened.
From the lock.
Again, right now the word is that congressional leaders believe that they have a deal to make this happen. It would be a lot more funding from the Pentagon. The overall omnibus bill, if they were to pass that, would also increase spending in other government areas as well. Is it going to pass? It seems like they think so, but there are some hurdles you still have to get over. One of them being, the budget hawks, especially the Freedom Caucus and the House of Representatives, they're not going to like it because reportedly what they're working on this deal would continue to grow the deficit. And then the other question is how will Democrats, I think, especially in the House, respond the fact that it seems as though they're now going to de-link the whole immigration issue and the Dreamers, DACA, this issue from the budgetary process. Not all Democrats are very happy about this. In fact, I saw Luis Gutierrez, a Democrat from Illinois, sort of probably the strongest congressional member who's fighting for immigrant rights, say this morning that there are two words one word that Democrat likes, and that's mañana, and one word that Republicans like, and that's nunca. He's talking about immigration, that Democrats are always, well, we'll deal with this tomorrow, and Republicans are saying that we'll never deal with this. So that's still to be seen. And here we are, again, if they don't strike a deal by midnight tomorrow, and these things are always fungible a little bit, but if they don't strike a deal tomorrow, then the government would shut down on Friday. So, you know, we've seen this before where we don't think it's going to shut down. Usually it doesn't when we talk about this, but something can go wrong. I think Donald Trump tried his very best yesterday to abrupt the process. So, but that's why I'm not sure if Donald Trump really understood the context of what he was saying, or if he's just saying it off the top of his head, because Donald Trump wanted to separate immigration from the budget process, unless now he wants to attach his wall, which is, as I said yesterday, I think is, you know, this is for him what this is all about. That's the issue. That's where we are in the budget process.
So what I read into his words was, give me $25 billion for a wall or don't pass a spending bill and shut down the government. Do we think he's serious, or he was just worried that the media's attention might be somewhere else for 5 minutes?
I don't know. You know, if Congress passes a budget deal and sends it to him, the president can veto it.
I think he likes having something to blame the Democrats for.
You know.
Right? To be able to, again, they shut down your government. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that plays a piece of it, too.
Yeah. Bring it on! Shut down the government! Oh, please don't shut down the government. It wouldn't be entirely your fault. Bring it on!
That part. Well, I mean, I think it would just be a typical right-wing spin.
But
a reality.
Yeah, I think the whole issue over the wall is I do think it's key for Trump. It was his number one campaign promise. Everyone laughed at him, Democrat and Republicans alike. And Donald Trump's that kind of guy that if you laughed at me over, some theorize that he ran for president because Barack Obama at a correspondence dinner one time went off on Donald Trump and embarrassed him. So it wouldn't surprise me this is all about Donald Trump vindicating himself over the wall and proving his doubters wrong. That said, I think Democrats are willing, at least in the Senate, are willing to de-link the immigration issue from the budget because It looks like Mitch McConnell's now going to have the debate next week to work on an immigration measure that deals with Dreamers and secure, you know, what they call border security. How much farther it will go beyond that is unknown. We don't know what the base bill will be. And I say base bill is sort of what they start off on. Mitch McConnell has promised everyone that they can have their all of the amendments will be voted on. It seems like it's going to be he's saying right now, and it looks like Democrats in the Senate believe him, that's going to be a very normal process in how you work on legislation, at least from the Senate floor. So he said specifically that whatever proposal gets 60 votes, that's the proposal that's going to pass through. You know, in past legislative fights, we've seen the leader only bring the legislation he supports, right, or the majority of the Republican Party supports. So he's keeping it much more open. I think that's why Democrats in the Senate are not so concerned about connecting the immigration to the budget. But again, it gets us into the other issue is we don't have that same kind of commitment in the House of Representatives. But next week is going to be a very important week, I think, on immigration. And I think this is when the debate's really going to begin. It looks like it is going to now happen next week.
Not satisfied with owning the news cycle with one set of explosive remarks. Donald Trump yesterday also called it treason that some people were not standing up and clapping during his State of the Union address. And moving on to our next topic.
Thank you.
Well, can I just couple that with something?
Must we?
Just quickly.
All right. I mean, I'll
be quiet.
It's exhausting.
Here on out after
this. Yeah, I don't want to be quiet. There's just pieces of this that are important, and they're important to national security, and they're important to the way that the country is moving forward, and we need to. But, like, there's some stuff that this man does. I want to talk about it. I want to talk about it. He's crazy. It's crazy. It's. I can't say that word. Go ahead, Mitch. You should talk because there's bad things
fair.
On the tip of my tongue.
I think it's fair. Well, yeah. Well, but Kat, don't look at me that way while I'm talking. I think it's fair what you're actually saying. And in fact, I think it would be inappropriate to look at what he was saying as anything else than tongue-in-cheek, kind of Donald Trump being Donald Trump. We expect this type of language with him. I can't help but notice, though, yesterday it was reported that Donald Trump also ordered the Pentagon to explore how we can have major military parades again in Washington, D.C.
Quote, like the one in France.
Or Bastille Day when he was when he witnessed Bastille Day. Now the first thing I thought about was sort of the old so. Well, a lot of countries do it. A lot of countries still do it today, right? Yeah. I mean, you'll see it in Egypt, you see
North Korea, Cuba,
and you bring out your tanks, you bring out your missiles, but you couple this with also, do I think that we have become a full-range fascist country? I don't. But we certainly, when they say Donald Trump has fascist tendencies, when he calls his political opponents treasonous, which of course, if you know, is the penalty for treason is death, and you start wanting to have military parades, it's hard to say that there's not some fascist tendencies this guy has.
And it's funny, and not funny, but in my house, like my husband's completely sort of, this is a fascist country, and you don't know what you're not seeing what's coming, and I'm telling you, Kat, it's coming, right? Just wait, they've got this agenda, and I'm on the other side sort of laughing and saying, it could never, it's not going to happen, and we have these very interesting debates, but my husband is absolutely convinced that we are walking the road towards full-blown fascism in this country.
I think maybe fascism the way reality TV is reality, as in it's not really.
Mm. Mm.
That's like you got to meditate on that, Brian.
Well,
that's
what I try to do is like make you think, Mitch Jezerich.
hey, Mitch, so is Trump going to talk to Mueller?
Yes. I don't know. It's interesting because right now the White House is looking at the Democratic memo from the House Intelligence Committee that is a response to the Nunes memo that we've already talked a great deal about. And just like the Nunes memo, it went through the White House and then they looked at it and then the White House said, okay, we're not redacting anything. You're free to release it. And now they're doing the same thing with the Democratic memo. The only difference is this time it's going to take about 5 days for Trump to do it rather than just a single day that happened with the Nunes memo. In defense of the White House over this, the Democratic memo is about three times as long as the Nunes memo, but neither of them are that long. I mean, we're talking like maybe 10 pages reportedly the Democratic memo is. But furthermore, he says he's going to have the FBI fully involved with trying to vet it and to redact things that need to be redacted. In fact, the New York Times is reporting that they do expect to see the president and the White House redact many things that are in the Democratic memo, which of course will then upset Democrats because they don't think anything in it should be redacted at all. That said, we'll probably see the memo by the end of this week, potentially as late as early next week. The reason I bring that up is because getting back to, is Trump going to actually talk to Robert Mueller? I think, you know, I've been watching a lot of Fox News, as you all know, and I think especially the Sean Hannity show has really become the PR machine for the Republican Party and for the White House concerning this issue over the Mueller investigation. And I say this because we already know that Sean Hannity was in the media, the biggest supporter of Trump in the campaign, and their relationship is very close. I also say this because the only media outlet right now that Devin Nunes, the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, is talking to is the is Fox and Sean Hannity. And so I actually recorded it because it gets so complicated, their theory of what's going on. And that doesn't make it wrong, but I have a hard time following it a little bit. There's a lot of arrows pointing different directions. And so I recorded it to watch it twice to make sure I really knew what was going on. I need to hear this again.
We need to come up with some metal for you.
Yeah, it's a chalkboard or something. You know, their theory is pretty fascinating. And what their theory is that the Clinton campaign and the Democratic Party hired, and they didn't originally do the hiring, as we know, it was the Washington Beacon Press, a conservative paper in Washington, D.C. that began, but then took over and then paid Fusion GPS, this group, who then paid Christopher Steele, this British intelligence officer, to find dirt on Donald Trump. And Christopher Steele actually went to Russia and got dirt on Donald Trump from Russian officials. And what they're saying is that there is a Russia conspiracy, but it's actually the Democrats and the Republicans who are involved in this conspiracy. It's not about the Trump campaign and Russia. And, you know, we're all missing it. And that's what this story is really about. I think what's happening, I think what the Nunes, and this is my own analysis, could be wrong, but I think what's happening with this Nunes memo and just the constant we're trying to upend and hurt this investigation by Mueller is I think it's to give cover to Donald Trump to say he's not going to talk to Mueller because it's a fraudulent investigation and they're out to get him and it's biased. And I think that was actually reported yesterday that his lawyers even were telling Donald Trump, we don't think you should talk to Mueller because if you do, it's very possible you'll get caught lying about something.
So apparently they are split. It's his private attorney saying that, right? That's apparently super concerned about the perjury exposure. And then Ty Cobb, who is his attorney through the Office of Legal Counsel, which is basically the lawyers that work for the president, if I understand it right, thinks he should, and obviously not perjure himself. But it's really an unanswered legal question whether he could be compelled to testify through subpoena.
To a grand jury.
Right, in front of a grand jury, which would be Mueller's next play. But mm-hmm. But that question, right, if Mueller got a subpoena and then Trump said, go to hell. You know, I've got a job to do. I'm the president of the United States. There's a separation of powers. That probably lands in front of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And the closest thing to a precedent is a 1974 ruling from the Watergate investigation when the recordings made in the Nixon White House of Richard Nixon's conversations were successfully subpoenaed after a long, drawn-out legal battle.
And that was the end of Nixon when that happened.
Right.
When the Supreme Court ruled. Nixon knew, saw the writing on the wall and then, you know, resigned not too long after. And the thing is, and you're right, the other thing I'd just add to that is that what Trump wants to do? And the Republicans, too. I mean, in some sense, they want this thing over. But if it goes to the Supreme Court, it's just going to be drawn out even longer than it otherwise would. So you want to get this all the way to the November midterm election. Maybe we'd even go farther than that. I don't know. So if they did do that, if that occurred, one thing we do know is it would probably prolong this entire process.
I'm kind of curious if there's anybody else who gets charged before it goes down with Trump. I mean, the fact that they're even talking about bringing him in for an interview suggests they're very close to the end of their investigation. But we haven't seen any big name indictments in the past couple months.
That's right. And I don't know if we are expecting more to come. We could say this is about Trump trying to protect Trump. It wouldn't surprise me. This is also about Trump trying to protect his family, especially Don Trump Jr. And this may not even, you know, he could be trying to protect his business connections. He could be trying to connect. I mean, there's so many things that are possibilities here, but yeah, we just don't know yet.
Steve Bannon apparently is holding out and going back to talk to the committee. He was supposed to do it yesterday. And then was the reporting was that he was going to refuse to go back and testify about stuff he did in the White House. And then that testimony has been postponed a week. And we don't know what kind of deal is being worked out in the intervening span of time.
And we'll see what happens next, right? I don't know, you know, what we're anticipating there. Other than, you know, it's Steve Bannon, somebody who's very close to the White House. I just think it's I wonder, you know, Chuck Grassley, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, also released a memo this week that hasn't got as much attention as the House memos have been getting. And his memo, again, is right with that line with Nunes about the real conspiracy is between Democrats, Hillary Clinton, and Russia, not Donald Trump and Russia. And these are the head of these committees. We talked about Nunes. You know, Nunes is on board with this theory. He's the head of this intelligence committee. I'm looking to see when do they start, if they start seriously going down that route of investigating that allegation. Because that would be interesting. I mean, yeah, right now we have a situation where the government is within inside the government. They're going after each other right now over, you know, really serious charges.
Fortunately, here in the Bay Area, we can take solace in the functionality of our local government. Cat Brooks was up late last night at the Oakland City Council meeting.
Oh my God. It's madness. So for folks who didn't tune in yesterday, we only have a couple of minutes, so I'm going to try to get through this as quickly as possible. Councilwoman Lynette McElhaney and Councilwoman Annie Campbell-Washington, with the co-signature of Larry Reed, brought to council last night a motion that would allow the council president to, at will, any time of day, any time of night, hour by hour, day by day, change the chair of council committees, right? For no reason at all.
So not take people off the committees, but take them out of the chair within the committee.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So myself and others and are clear that some of this is about the fact that Desley Brooks is vulnerable because of her issue with Elaine Brown that is moving through the courts right now, and that there's been these, you know, personality clashes on the council. I mean, Lynette and Desley have been outwardly hostile to each other for quite a while now. But this is an opportunity to remove Desley from chairing the public safety committee that she chairs right now. And so lots of folks came out and spoke not only in defense of Desi, but more so the real issue is about, do you really, whether the council president is Larry Reed or somebody else, do you really want one person to have this kind of power? And per usual, Abel and Annie and Larry and just sort of looked at community and were like, whatever.
I love how you're on a first name basis with every one you don't like on the council.
You know. And then, Libby, Larry seems to really enjoy utilizing the police in city council meetings. So Jonah Strauss, a local activist who was actually validly questioning whether or not the Brown Act had been violated in the way in which this resolution was brought to council, when he wouldn't stop asking his question and waiting for an answer, Larry had him escorted out by the Oakland Police Department. Then Etta Johnson, whose son was murdered by the Oakland Police Department, had a valid emotional breakdown at council. Larry then too tried to have the Oakland Police Department come escort her out, but community surrounded her and stopped that from happening and made sure she was okay. At the end of the day, the resolution passed. Terha Alka, local community activist, said, well, if this is really not about Desley, then Desley's chair should be safe. So we shall see what happens moving forward.
And that takes us to 7:30 in the morning. Programs up front. Mitch Jezerich, what do you got coming up at 10?
We are going to be speaking to Loke Johnson. He was a lead investigator on the church committee in the 1970s. That's how we end up getting not just the FISA courts, but it's also through the investigation into abuses of intelligence agencies is how we also get the creation of both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees.
And the de-hooverization of the FBI. Very cool. I'm going to tune in for that, or actually probably listen to it later in the archive.
Thank you for telling the truth.
It's in the middle of our editorial meeting. coming up next, we're going to talk all nukes for the next hour and a half. We will go through the new nuclear posture review that was issued by the Trump administration on Friday when they roll out all good news. Includes a lot of interesting provisions to talk about, including there's now a new threshold for launching a nuclear strike under the new document. It can be done in response to a cyber attack. Then we'll talk to Daniel Ellsberg. He helped plan nuclear strategy for the RAND Corporation. For the United States government, and has just written a book about that.
I mean, there's a lot of new stuff in there.
Yeah.
We didn't know about.
Right.
There's a whole new set of papers.
Terrifying. That's all coming up next, after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. Senate negotiators are working to hammer out a long-term budget deal that would avert tomorrow night's looming government shutdown. The deal was picking up steam even as Donald Trump vowed he'd be happy to trigger a government shutdown for his demands on immigration.
Our country and continue to kill gang members. And we're just talking about MS-13. There are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown. And it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of.
The House last night passed a six-week stopgap spending bill largely along party lines. It contains increases for the military that long have been demanded by Trump and his Republican allies. But the measure appears increasingly likely to be rewritten by the Senate to include legislation implementing a broader budget deal. In Taiwan, officials report six dead, more than 250 injured, and 76 missing after yesterday's 6.4 magnitude earthquake struck off the island's east coast. The quake caused at least four buildings to cave in and shift on their foundations. Aftershocks continue to rock the hard-hit city of Hualien, complicating the search for survivors. The Santa Clara County Board of Supervisors has placed the recall of Judge Aaron Persky on the June ballot after recall supporters gathered enough signatures. Recall organizers say Persky gave too light a sentence to former Stanford University swimmer Brock Turner after he was convicted of sexually assaulting an unconscious woman. Persky was following a Santa Clara County Probation Department recommendation when he sentenced Turner to 6 months in jail. He served only three. Turner also has had to register for life as a sex offender. The push to recall Persky is led by Stanford University law professor Michelle Dauber. Casino billionaire mogul Steve Wynn has stepped down as chair and CEO of the resorts bearing his name. Wynn is facing investigations by gambling regulators and allegations of rape and sexual harassment. Wynn's resignation Tuesday was effective immediately. It came less than 2 weeks after the Wall Street Journal reported a number of women said Wynn harassed or assaulted them, and that one case led to a $7.5 million settlement. Wynn resigned as finance chairman of the Republican National Committee a day after the allegations were published. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny, continued warm, highs in the mid-70s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy morning fog, then sunny and hazy, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 8 o'clock.
Join KPFA's Mandala Radio Collective on Saturday, February 10th, as we present 12 hours of special programming celebrating Black History and African Heritage Month from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. Hear the voices, stories, music, and culture from African people in the diaspora. That's Saturday, February 10th, from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. right here on listener-sponsored radio, 94.1 FM, or kpfa.org. Rising in power.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1 and KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, and K248BR 97.5 in Santa Cruz. You can stream KPFA online or listen to our archive shows anytime at kpfa.org.
California. It is 7:35 in the morning. That was Tupac Shakur. This show is up front.
Was that California Dream? I mean, not California.
Go ahead, Brad. I'm gonna let you go ahead.
I messed up. When this was like California.
Oh, okay, it is 7:36 in the morning. You are listening up front. I am Kat Brooks. I'm here with Brian Edward Secret. Brian, moving right along. What are we
talking
about?
California knows how to party.
No, okay. Brian. No. Nukes. You're talking about nukes now. Nukes.
So. When I was an environmental beat reporter, there was this strange phenomenon during the George W. Bush administration, which is that very significant announcements would get made very close to the end of the day on Friday, when all of the environmental reporters at the newspapers that used to still exist back then were just about to punch out for the week. And we learned that this had a phrase within the Bush administration, which was taking out the trash. Burying stories that the administration didn't want to get too much play at a time when there weren't too many people who had pretty good BS filters to check on it. So late Friday, Trump administration releases a document. It's called the Nuclear Posture Review. This is a document that is updated periodically to chart a strategic course for the United States nuclear arsenal, the largest of its kind in the world. And it had some pretty big things buried in it. Few points of controversy, as I understand it, and I am not a nuke expert. It continues a process that started under the Obama administration of rebuilding nuclear weapons and, quote unquote, modernizing them. In some cases, that means making them more destructive. It also calls for dramatically increasing the number of small tactical nuclear weapons so that the United States can respond in kind if a power like Russia decides to use a battlefield nuclear weapon in a conventional war situation. And most notably, and I hope to get into this with our guest, it widens the scope of situations in which the United States could launch a nuclear attack and could launch a first nuclear attack to include a cyber attack on the United States command and control infrastructure. So we could respond to hacking with a nuke. Now, joining us to parse up what's in the document, we have Greg Mello. He is executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. They are a nuclear disarmament research and advocacy organization based in New Mexico near the Los Alamos site. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Can you kind of just walk us through what the Nuclear Posture Review is? But before we get into the specifics of this one, like, what function does the document perform?
Yes. It's kind of part of a package of national security policy documents, fits in with the overall national security strategy of the Trump administration, then another thing called the National Defense Strategy. It comes out irregularly. The last one was in 2010. One before that was in 2001 under Bush. It's a set of guidelines. It's not a detailed plan. It's kind of just an overarching strategy.
So when it calls for things like changing the circumstances under which the United States could launch a nuclear strike to include a cyber attack, does that mean the U.S. arsenal is actually on a new footing, or that they want to do additional work to put it on that new footing?
Yes. One of the things that this nuclear posture review has accomplished is waking up people to what has been the case all along. And I think it's important to understand that. That always was the strategy. And Trump has just made it, he's kind of showcased it. Obama, in his strategy, suppressed a lot of unpleasant ideas, but they were definitely au courant in the military papers and congressional testimony and other details that didn't make it into the headlines. So that's not a new thing. That's just implicit in the United States in the logic of not relinquishing the right to make a first strike with nuclear weapons on after some sort of provocation or some sort of military or homeland security event.
So as I understand, the logic of it is if you suddenly had a hacking blitz against the U.S. command and control system, right? If someone was, say, taking out the satellites that the United States uses to detect incoming nukes, the government is now saying it would perceive that as a signal of an impending nuclear strike and try to preempt it with its own.
It might. So there's nothing fixed about this. So every president from the beginning of the nuclear age has been quite ambiguous, and that ambiguity is part of the deterrence strategy. So in other words, nobody can be quite sure what we would do. Nixon articulated it even a little bit farther, saying that the president should have a posture of semi-madness because only someone who is crazy would actually use nuclear weapons. In order to have a credible deterrent, you have to project the idea that you might be a little unhinged. So that's kind of always been there, that ambiguity, and there's nothing in here that's like a machine that says, you know, it has this input, it'll produce that output. So that said, I think that there's a lot to be alarmed about, because taking a step back, it is like a machine in that the military mind is all over this administration, and this document is completely devoid of any diplomacy, non-proliferation. It's really all about war fighting and how we would fight wars against our newly proclaimed adversaries, namely Russia and China. That is very dangerous.
What is substantively different from the last nuclear posture review, the one that was produced under the Obama administration?
Well, there's a lot substantively different in in comparison to the 2010 NPR. Obama, unfortunately, moved far to the right on nuclear weapons by the time he left office. He committed to the most tremendous investment in nuclear weapons since Ronald Reagan. He started that commitment in 2010, just after he finished the nuclear posture review. But the narrow answer to your question, what's different is the creation of low-yield nuclear weapons strike options in addition to the warheads we already have, which include low-yield strike options. The difference being that today's low-yield options would have to be delivered by airplanes, and our adversaries, so-called Russia and China, now have very potent and increasingly potent air defense systems. So they want missiles now, cruise missiles and ballistic missiles that could deliver low-yield nuclear weapons in the event of a conflict.
What does a low-yield nuclear weapon do for them that a big one doesn't?
What they claim is that it signals a willingness to not be trapped in a suicidal, a willingness to use a nuclear weapon, in other words, a credible deterrent. Now, this logic has been there all along, and it's kind of horrifying, but they have twisted the screw another quarter turn. So if they want to deter the use of low-yield nuclear weapons against U.S. expeditionary forces around the world, say, for example, in a war against Russia on Russia's borders. They don't want Russia to defend itself with low-yield nuclear weapons on the theory that those weapons would not incur a comparable response from the United States. Their theory is that having these low-yield nuclear weapons will restrain Russia. That's not my theory, but I don't think it's a good idea. I think it goes the other way. I think that when we start saying we are going to elaborate the number of low-yield tactical nuclear weapons, the number of strike modes that we could use, I think that that stimulates symmetric and asymmetric responses from other states who say, well, who feel threatened. This document is somewhat unique in that it is a testament or cry of weakness on the part of the United States. I've never seen anything like it. So in order
why do you say that, that it's a testament of weakness as opposed to what I assume that the Trump administration's purpose is to show strength and bravado?
Yes, that's what they, but actually, I think they used the word weakness, if not in this document, in the National Security Strategy. It's just replete with statements, and there's just been congressional testimony, including yesterday, that, oh my gosh, the U.S. is falling behind in a nuclear arms race with Russia and China. Look at all of their new nuclear weapons systems. What are we going to do? How can we defend ourselves and regain our competitive edge in a world where these rising powers threaten our forces around the world? That's kind of the tone of it.
So it's like the missile gap rhetoric from the 1950s recycled.
Yes, yes, it is, very much. So all of a sudden, this has no relation to reality. It's a perception on the part of people who feel that the normal state of things is that the United States should be able to dictate terms, diplomatic and military, all around the world without taking other countries into consideration. Well, that's an impossible goal. So they feel weak in relation to that goal.
Speaking to Greg Mello, he's executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. That is a nuclear disarmament research and advocacy organization based in New Mexico. And the topic of our discussion is the release on Friday of an updated nuclear posture review from the Trump administration. Among other things, it calls for a dramatic expansion in the U.S. inventory of low-yield nuclear weapons, including putting low-yield nuclear missiles on submarines. And it changes the scope of circumstances under which the United States might launch a first nuclear strike to explicitly include a cyber attack. Greg Mello, let's get for a minute into the actual cost of this. The estimated price tag on the arsenal upgrades that the Obama administration had already greenlighted was somewhere in the vicinity of $1.2 trillion. Do we have any notion how far beyond that price tag this document takes us?
Not a very good guess yet. Of course, I'm sure you know, and listeners should know, that 1.2 did not include some of the cost inflation that we certainly expect from Department of Energy warhead programs, and it didn't include the environmental cost, which mounts higher and higher year after year. So if you include those kind of things, it's really, you know, gets closer to $2 trillion before Trump's NPR. Trump's NPR will increase costs, and it's not clear yet how much. The low-yield Trident ballistic missile is probably not very expensive. The submarine-launched cruise missile is more expensive. They did cancel an Obama warhead, which affects the Bay Area, because Livermore Lab was the primary lab for this so-called interoperable warhead. Obama was unable to listen to his advisors that eventually realized that this was a bad idea, but because it was an Obama idea, the Trump administration is able to let go of it. The military didn't like it in the end, but it's a Livermore Lab idea to keep themselves in business and flush with cash over there. So the labs liked it, and but we're done with that, and there'll be some savings there, about $15 billion, that they can apply to their new weapons. I don't think it'll cover it. So I think there's a net increase in cost, but we'll find out maybe a little bit more this coming Monday when the budget request is released.
Who within the Trump administration wants this? Like, do you have a sense of, like, who's winning the debates and policy discussions when it comes to the nuclear arsenal?
That's a really good question. The person who was in charge of drafting this was John McCain's right-hand person on the Senate Armed Services Committee, Rob Suffer, who was taken over to the Pentagon to be in charge of writing this. And he is a prominent neoconservative. And he brought in, literally, old cold warriors from the Reagan administration who believed in nuclear victory over Russia, who have written things like the United States could attack Russia and sustain only 20 million dead, and that this would be victory. These people were the original drafters of this nuclear posture review. Then it went into a big fight over the course of this year with budget hawks and ordinary generals and sort of narrowly sane people talking back all of this crazy stuff that was in there. Well, of course, they didn't get it all. Some got through. So it's a struggle, and I think we'll see more struggle. Past nuclear posture reviews have not been good predictors of what actually happened. So George W. Bush wrote a super hawkish nuclear posture review, and it was actually written by the same people. And but the Congress, including Republicans, walked it back a long way, very far. So and Obama wrote an ostensibly more dovish one, and then he got walked the other way by the rising power of neoconservatives, especially in this second term. So there's a lot of fighting to do over this now, and I think some of us would like to end these crazy, like low-yield ballistic missiles, which no one can tell when, you know, ballistic missile is coming your way. What is it exactly? Is this an all-out strike? Is this a tactical weapon? I don't think the submarine commanders are going to like giving away where their positions are. There's a lot of problems with these things, and it's I think the battle is just beginning.
I'm specifically interested in the kind of turnaround from the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. He had been somewhat skeptical of expanding and upgrading the U.S. nuclear arsenal and the cost-benefit ratio on that before joining mm-hmm. the Trump administration. Now he's defending this new document.
Yes, that's a really good point. What the heck happens to people? They go in there, and the peer pressure is enormous. The arguments within the old frame of reference somehow take people over. What I would say is that there's really an absence of civilian leadership in this document. All we've had on the civilian side are these neocons. There's no statesmanship. There's no broader strategy about the United States' role in the world. The liberal end of this document was people like Mattis. And so it's a very good question. What happens to people? And, you know, we may use words like the deep state. The momentum and force of the permanent Washington establishment makes it very difficult for any but a very strong leader to overcome it.
So what's the escalation scenario that you worry about? Is this something to worry about as more than just a colossal waste of resources?
Yes. I'm very worried that because the United States is that there will be a perception that we can't give in a given conflict. Let's take North Korea. That will lose too much face. And without really knowing it, U.S. leaders will pass over a kind of watershed where the use of force, military force, becomes more and more likely and then inevitable. And when dealing with advanced adversaries, let's say China, nuclear weapons might seem to a frightened president or a hardened general the right thing to do. So suppose that we got in a conflict with China and U.S. aircraft carriers were sunk and thousands of U.S. sailors were killed. There'd be an outcry. Well, there'd be pressure. That's the scenario that I'm most worried about, and I am worried about it because there's a finite amount of non-renewable resources in the world, like oil. The so-called abundance really isn't there. China's use of oil is growing very fast, and basically there's a collision course between great powers, and there's a lot of pressure on the U.S. government because of capitalists in this country that want, nobody wants to be in charge of decline. So this is a World War I type scenario where there ends up being a much more difficult to understand overall tide toward war than the experts who are in the middle of the machine really understand. That's what I'm worried about.
And yet, even as this document comes out, the latest iteration of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Russia goes into effect this week.
Yes.
You described the Nuclear Posture Review as not substantive and not even necessarily indicative of the direction an administration's going to take. The START Treaty is substantive. It's binding, isn't it?
Yes, it is binding. Medvedev said that Russia might pull out of this treaty this year, back when it was signed, over the deployment of ballistic missile defense in Europe, the upgrades of missile defense on Russia's borders, and in any case, the treaty expires in 3 years. So it's a temporary and rather limited treaty, and we still have thousands of nuclear weapons. Now, not just the ones on alert, but we have others, even more, in reserve that we are prepared to upload onto our missiles or onto our bombers. And so Russia has the same. So we have 4,500 nuclear weapons in readily usable condition right now, not the New START limit of 1550.
But it really only takes one, right? I mean, like...
Yes, exactly. What people have forgotten, I think, if they ever knew, how powerful and terrible nuclear weapons are. It's... I don't myself know whether the United States, as the United States, could recover from even a single nuclear weapon. It's a kind of imponderable subject.
Yeah, I mean, I think people forget, and I know we have to wrap up, but Japan is still feeling, you know, Okinawa is still feeling the impacts of that nuclear weapon.
Yes, and I think that it's important, maybe last seconds that I probably have, that for everyone, I think, needs to think about the big issues that we face. And I'm concerned that sometimes we get distracted by relatively small things, even though they're important. But climate change and war and peace, the big direction of our country, which you brought up here, the cost. These national security documents are aimed at really undercutting the social contract of the whole country, such as it is. And we have to realize that we can't win on the justice issues that the relatively micro justice issues when we are throwing people out of work because we have to have a $700 billion military and a $1.7 trillion nuclear program.
All right. Greg Mello, that is all the time we have. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you so much.
Greg Mello is executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. They are a nuclear disarmament research and advocacy organization based in New Mexico.
And you heard him on 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. Brian, what's in the second hour?
Dan Ellsberg. It turns out when he walked out of the RAND Corporation with 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers, he also took with him thousands of pages of nuclear war planning documents that he had worked on and has not written about them until now in a book that just came out called The Doomsday Machine. We will discuss it next after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandari with KPFA News headlines. The deadline for another stopgap spending bill runs out tomorrow night. Lawmakers say they are on track to avoid a repeat of last month's government shutdown, though Donald Trump unexpectedly raised that possibility if he doesn't get his way on immigration.
If we don't get rid of these loopholes where killers are allowed to come into our country and continue to kill gang members, and we're just talking about MS-13, there are many gang members that we don't even mention. If we don't change it, let's have a shutdown. We'll do a shutdown, and it's worth it for our country. I'd love to see a shutdown if we don't get this stuff taken care of.
The House passed a six-week stopgap spending measure last night on a largely party-line vote. Senate leaders are closing in on a larger long-term pact. The broader agreement would award large spending increases to both the Pentagon and domestic federal programs, as well as approve overdue disaster relief. Democratic leaders have dropped the strategy of using the funding fight to extract concessions on immigration, specifically on seeking extended protections for the young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers brought to this country as children. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly threw fuel on the dispute as he defended Trump's proposed solution. The retired general noted the White House proposal would expand protection to include 1.8 million people, far more than the 690,000 who currently have DACA protections. He said Trump's proposal would include some people who were, quote, too lazy to sign up previously.
There are 690,000 official DACA registrants, and the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 million were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up.
House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi said this morning Trump's anti-immigrant views break with those of previous Republican presidents.
So now we have the first Republican president in modern times, the first president, really, who is anti-immigrant. And that is just such a change from his own party. And it makes it hard to see where we can have shared values.
Doctors at Children's Hospital in Oakland rallied to support a Clean Dream Act to protect undocumented youth. They said it's a matter of public health. Christopher Martinez filed this report.
No ban, no wall, sanctuary for all, no ban.
Dozens of resident physicians showed their support for undocumented children and families as they rallied outside UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland. The doctors say DACA and immigration enforcement more broadly is a public health issue. Dr. Noemi Spinazzi says immigrant families are getting sicker and more reticent to seek care because of fear of deportation.
So many physicians are gathered here today because the anti-immigration, xenophobic rhetoric promoted by some of our leaders poses a direct threat to our public health of our nation and our communities.
Other doctors share those concerns.
We're here to provide a service for these families, but in order to continue to provide those families these services, we need to know that they're going to still be here next year.
Dr. Michael Mungajas is a pediatric resident.
It's hard to treat a patient who's afraid of coming to clinic because they're afraid either themselves or their parents are going to be deported. And, you know, in pediatrics, we pride ourselves in preventative care, and we have regular routine well-child visits, and we see a lot of no-shows because of these issues. And so we're missing out on the opportunities for health counseling and screening for these children.
Mungajas says the doctors are fighting with their voices, but later they'll be fighting with their votes in this election year. Reporting from UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital in Oakland, I'm Christopher Martinez.
San Francisco Board of Supervisors President London Breed has introduced legislation that would eliminate criminal justice fees charged to formerly incarcerated people. Fees for ankle monitoring at $35 a day. Participation in the sheriff's work alternative program at $20 a day. Probation and more. Reed said the fees, 10 of them altogether, can add up to thousands of dollars and hinder reentry after incarceration.
We should not allow these fines and fees to be barriers to making sure that they have an opportunity to succeed in life. They've already paid their debt to society, yet outside, they are shackled by the financial debt that these fees bring to the table.
Breed said the fees particularly affect people of color. African Americans account for less than 6% of San Francisco's population, but make up over half the population in the county jail. Joseph Williams, who has two children, faces thousands in criminal justice fees.
I got hit with the fees when I was making plans with my family to do things, you know, when we're actively engaging in moving up in life, you know, like, oh, let's check out this new apartment building. Let's get this new car, pay this car note, this insurance, you know, renter's insurance, all of these things. And then these fines and fees hit me. And now I'm stuck in a situation where I'm late on my insurance. I'm late on this. It's affecting my credit negatively, you know? I feel like I paid my debt to society, and not only that, I'm actively giving back to society.
Breed said a large number of people can't and don't pay the fees, and the program is costly to administer. New airstrikes launched by Russian and Syrian government forces on a besieged rebel-held region east of Damascus killed at least 8 people, according to opposition activists. The airstrikes on eastern Ghouta have killed dozens of civilians in the past few days. The punishing campaign by Russia in Syria also has battered the northwestern province of Idlib. A hospital official in Idlib stood among the ruins of his facility. His remarks were broadcast on Al Jazeera.
The third airstrike was the most intense. It destroyed the entire hospital. I'm sorry to say that we've lost a huge medical institution serving the entire area. I have no alternative. Everyone is asking me where to go. I have no answer.
The children's organization Save the Children said the escalation in fighting in opposition-held Idlib is placing thousands of children in extreme danger. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny, continued warm, highs in the mid-70s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy morning fog, then sunny and hazy, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 8:30.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. To grow up during the Cold War was to grow up knowing you were in the crosshairs of nuclear arsenals that could practically wipe out human civilization in a matter of hours. Kids learned this early, and the issue would dominate national politics. But today, a lot of us treat that like an artifact of the past, when in fact there are more nuclear powers in the world today than ever before, when the same Cold War arsenals of the United States and Russia are still on hair triggers, still subject to roughly the same war doctrines and war plans and command structures that they were a generation ago. Our next guest should know. He helped draft some of those plans. Daniel Ellsberg is most famous for leaking the Pentagon Papers and helping to end the Vietnam War. But before then, he helped draft nuclear war plans under the Kennedy administration. And when he copied the Pentagon Papers, he copied his war planning documents as well. Those documents and that work are the subject of his newest book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Dan Ellsberg, thank you for coming in.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I would just like to start with your life. How does an intelligent, moral human being come to start drafting plans for nuclear war?
The answer is pretty easy in terms of the period of the Cold War. The idea of deterrence I grew up with, and the idea that the Russians were part of a worldwide effort to dominate the world, really, by nuclear threats and nuclear force if necessary, was part of what I came to accept in my growing up. Really going back to the era when I was 17 of the Berlin blockade, where Russians were trying to incorporate West Berlin into the Eastern Bloc, which was already recognizable as a tyranny as it was. What was greatly exaggerated in retrospect was not Stalin's ruthlessness or his dictatorial qualities, but the notion that his determination to expand into West Europe and the rest of the world was like that of Hitler, that he was a Hitler with nuclear weapons. And that was broadcast by, you know, every major official, really, at that time, taken for granted. And it was not implausible, given the tyrannical rule over East Europe. Now, the simple notion, which was the reality, that Soviet Union or any other Russian regime did not want to face a resurgent Germany that would threaten it or invade it through the invasion routes of Poland or Hungary, as they had twice in the last century, was hardly obvious as that though might seem, hardly even mentioned as a possibility, that there was a defensive aspect to their control of East Europe, as in the Soviet Union. And so it looked aggressive, and the idea that they were ahead of us seemed to be validated by the fact that they were ahead of us in the first launch of an ICBM some time before we were able to do it, their launch of an Earth satellite, which had been projected by the Rand Corporation as early as 1946 in a study, but which we had not developed the capability of putting that up yet. So the idea that they were ahead of us in that and might well use that either to blackmail or actually carry out a surprise attack seemed very plausible. It was wrong. It was plausible that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, actually, in 2002 and 2003. But it didn't. That was as much of a delusion or a hoax as was the missile gap in the late 50s, the notion that the Russians were superior. So, in short, what I was doing with an abhorrence of nuclear war was to try to lower the possibility of a nuclear war, which I thought was posed only by a Russian aggressiveness and likelihood of a surprise attack. What I was doing was to try to deter that by having a retaliatory capability. What I learned in 1961, and I really start the book with this, was later in the year, in 1961, that the notion of a Russian surprise attack was totally delusory, like the Saddam Hussein's WMD. Whereas I had heard myself at SAC, Strategic Air Command headquarters, in August of 1961, that the head of Strategic Air Command, Thomas Power, believed that they had 1,000 ICBMs. at a time when we had 40. In fact, a month later, it was clear that what they had was 4. He was wrong by 250 times, not 250%, 250 times. Now, the CIA and other people had put the superiority of the Russians much lower, but still around 160, 120 to our 40. In fact, we also had several thousand bombers in range of Russia. They had 192, roughly, in range of the United States. In short, there was a great gap, and it was vastly in favor of the U.S. And from that time on, and especially the next year in the Cuban Missile Crisis, I became aware that there was indeed a danger of nuclear war from U.S. escalation of a conflict, as might have happened in Cuba or Berlin, or an accidental or false alarm, such as occurred when I was working for the Pentagon. In fact, in 1960, there was a major false alarm, the first time they turned on the ballistic missile early warning system, the BMUSE system. And for that occasion, to initiate these massive radars that were to detect a Soviet missile attack in 1960 now, there was suddenly a warning that a missile attack was on the way. And the executives from Bell and Howell and IBM and others who had helped build this system were quickly ushered into an adjoining room while klaxons were going off and lights were flashing and people were preparing for preemption somehow. It turned out, a very serious alert, it turned out that the first time it was turned on, essentially, the BMUSE radars were bouncing off the moon. And we knew they would reach the moon, but the engineers had not figured that the return signal would be as strong as it actually was, and it registered as an incoming missile attack. Now, that was unlikely to be believed, really, though it really worried people, because I think they secretly knew that their estimates were wrong, and the Russians just didn't have that many missiles, as were being recorded. But that was an early, and there had been examples earlier, but there have been recurrent false alarms like that. And I've lived for over 50 years now with the awareness that with the missiles still on alert on both sides, the possibility of nuclear war has remained all this time well above zero, whatever it is. When you say that the public is not aware of this, is not thinking about it, that's true. But in part, that's because the Cold War did end. The idea of the Russians even being an enemy, hostile nation, ended with the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and the ending even of the USSR itself in 1989, 90, 91. And really, after that, there was a period when Russia wanted that if to be part of NATO, unless NATO were dissolved, which it should have been at that point with the ending, the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact. Its enemy forces, ultimately, wrongly, by terrible strategic political blunder, ended up in NATO. And from that point on, the idea of a Russian threat to Europe, West Europe in particular, has become totally delusional. But Russia itself wanted to be part of that, was held off. And during that period, it didn't seem there was any possibility of a Russian attack, of course. And I would say, well, one can say that was right. It was wrong. Because in 1995, with the weapons still remaining on both sides and being alert on both sides, in 1995, Yeltsin, as president, was confronted for the first time any head of state had been confronted with his open computer, his briefcase, so-called his football, as we call it, because what looked like an American submarine launch missile, Trident missile, was heading either toward Moscow or toward electromagnetic pulse, a high-level explosion that would turn off their electronics and decapitate their command and control. And he could have indeed ordered a preemptive attack at that point. And remember, that's in 1995. That's well over 4 years after the Cold War has ended, meaning this risk on both sides has remained. The hostility went away for a while, now being renewed, but the weapons did not. And although the numbers of weapons did decline mutually by as much as 85% less than what they had earlier, which would seem a major reduction. The fact is that the remaining missiles, 1,500 on each side on alert and about 4,000 operational, and another 4,000 to 5,000 on the shelf, the 1,500 are far more than is needed right now to cause a nuclear winter, near extinction, something we didn't worry about in the 60s or 70s because no one had conceived of it. But for 30 years now, we've known that hitting military targets in cities and burning those cities by the hundreds on both either side would cause the firestorms resulting to loft very high updrafts, smoke and toxic soot by the hundreds of millions of tons into the stratosphere where it wouldn't rain out and where it would circle the globe and reduce sunlight by about 70%, causing perpetual winter down below, ice age conditions, freezing a lot of water, but in particular, killing all the harvests worldwide, southern hemisphere as well, so that humanity would nearly all starve. Extinction is unlikely, very unlikely. Near extinction is almost certain. 1%, 2% may survive in the southern hemisphere in New Zealand or Australia eating mollusks and fish. And indefinitely for who knows how long, unless ozone depletion from the war kills them off also. But 98 or 99% of humans would be gone. And the fact that this, now that we know this, the idea that such systems remain on alert, coupled to each other with possible false warning, is not just outrageous and immoral and evil and insane. It's all of those. There really are no words to describe it. Humans don't have a language for maintaining a capability for near extinction of the human species. It was never possible before 70 years ago or even before 50 years ago. But for half a century, it has not only been possible, it's been threatened, prepared for. We have no more intense activity of any sort than maintaining a capability for near extinction. And I don't mean just annihilation of Russia or its allies. I repeat, near extinction. For that to persist at all is, again, no words, but outrageous. It cannot be justified by any moral system that's ever been conceived by humans could justify that threat and that capability. And yet, here it is, and we are spending $1.5 trillion programmed by President Obama and expanded by President Trump to rebuild that doomsday machine in all of its dangerous characteristics, and Putin is doing the same. Each has a military-industrial complex now. They've always had it. It used to be purely bureaucratic on the Russian side, but now it's profit-making in the same way that ours is. They have the same incentives to build these weapons, mainly profits, jobs, votes, retirement incomes, a lobby, basically, that we do. And these two lobbies, these two systems within a system, and the whole system as a whole, one would have to say, is based on the readiness for extermination.
There's a certain logic, a certain rationality to that.
Really? What is that?
Well, it's what your colleague Herman Kahn summarized in his Doomsday Machine report.
But his point was that was an insane, that no one would produce such a thing. He said it's a hypothetical concept, a system that would destroy life on Earth. But if you think twice about it, you'll see that it, quote, kills too many people too automatically. So Herman said in 19, my colleague, in 59 and 60 and 61, there is no such system, doomsday machine, and there never will be one. No one will choose to build one. It's expensive enough that there'll be enough controversy about it. It won't get built, even if somebody proposes it. He was wrong. It existed then, and it's existed ever since.
In the form of mutually assured destruction.
Well, that's the reality of what would happen with our plans. The plans actually have never aimed at mutually assured destruction. They've always aimed on both sides at limiting damage by striking first rather than the second, so that although the destruction would be terrible in any case, if you strike first with these weapons, let's say take out their intercontinental ballistic missiles, you'll be damaged less than if you let them strike first. Well, the question always was, since the mid-60s for the U.S., what about their sub-launched missiles, which we can't target? That'll be bad, actually would destroy us as a society, but surely it's better to get rid of their intercontinental ballistic missiles with our ICBMs that are very accurate. They've just gotten more accurate, by the way, as Ted Postal and some others have shown, by new superfuses that we're putting on our ICBMs that make our SLBMs, sub-launch missiles, as accurate and destructive as our ICBMs. Wonderful. That's just the last few years. Very secretly, they've been doing this. To what effect? Well, to get rid of their ICBMs. Very good. It can't that be, you know, would you rather have those two? The answer is no, it really doesn't make any difference. The sub-launch missiles alone are far more than enough to cause nuclear winter, and that causes near death, not right away, but within months or a year, on both sides, whichever strikes first. That's the reality. And that reality is being ignored and react as if it didn't exist. Nuclear winter, we act as if no one had ever heard of that. That's something that was discussed 30 years ago, 40 years ago, in 1983, 35 years ago. A lot of people feel it was disproved by the end of the year, there was a century, that it was hoax, a delusion, like Y2K, the worry that people had at the millennium. And a lot of people believe, according to scientists I've talked to, that it was disproven, it went away. That was not true. And in the last 10 years, new studies by Alan Roebuck and Brian Toon and others have shown that even India and Pakistan, without using thermonuclear weapons and with a fraction of the weapons they now have, would lead to a diminution of, if they went to war, of sunlight, perhaps 7% instead of 70%, that would lead to the death by starvation, by ending harvests, of 2 billion people. They don't have any right to threaten 2 billion people, to risk that. But we would lead to the diminution of 70%, and we would kill nearly everybody. And obviously, we don't have a right to risk that, threaten that, prepare that, and yet that's what we're doing.
So explain the logic from the point of view of a war planner in the 1960s of building the nation's plans and its nuclear infrastructure around a first strike doctrine.
Well, the commitment, our role in Europe, which gave us, made us in effect a nuclear power, I'm sorry, a European power, was based on our nuclear monopoly at that time. It started as a monopoly. And the idea that we could confront the Soviet threat with our monopoly of nuclear weapons. Well, that monopoly ended 4 years into the era in 1949. By early 50, it was true, I mean, it's the early 50s, that the Russians could retaliate and annihilate Europe long before they could hit the United States. But NATO's nuclear policy was based on that from the beginning. So it isn't only the U.S. that's in a state of denial about this. People in Europe who urged us to be very firm on Berlin and risk war, which would be nuclear war, it's not clear to me to this day how clear they were that what they were talking about was their own annihilation. Of course, they didn't want it to happen, and of course, they hoped it would be deterred. But it was never certain to be deterred, and if it didn't, they would be gone. And I keep quoting Lindsey Graham, but you say, how could the Pentagon have done this? Well, it's the same theory. The deaths will be over there. But by the mid-60s, as I say, it was very clear, as late as that, that they wouldn't be over there. We would also be annihilated. Now, today, I saw an article on the web by Eric Margolis on a Russian system of the ultimate deterrent, which we're now taking very seriously, of a 100-megaton submarine weapon that would explode off the West Coast and another on the East Coast that would make the East Coast and the West Coast uninhabitable for generations by radioactivity. If we're talking first use in the Baltics, and it's a little hard to defend the Baltics against Russians with anything other than first use, except that first use of nuclear weapons leads to the annihilation of the Baltics and the rest of Europe. Likewise, Poland. Likewise, Ukraine. So much. Isn't that crazy? Yes. But Putin is doing the same thing, probably for the same reasons. In other words, there are benefits. There's the profits, the jobs, but also you might deter. Kim Jong-un can deter up to a point with his nuclear weapons right now. Clearly, it's not good enough. It's not stopping us from making threats, you know, every other day by Trump. Well, he wants a better deterrent, as Khrushchev did in 1962. He wants a missile deterrent that will reach the United States, which he doesn't have yet. And Khrushchev didn't have that in 62, looking at Berlin and the loss of Cuba to our covert operations. So Khrushchev put missiles in Cuba that could reach the United States. That was the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now Kim Jong-un is going for ICBMs and H-bombs that can reach the United States. Really, and it's, I mean, Graham simply is the most explicit on this, but it's to refute Lindsey Graham's point, the golf partner of Trump, that the casualties will all be over there. That's what Khrushchev was trying to refute. Well, it could work. It could deter us. Or it might not. It could provoke an attack. And that's clearly what's possible right now. So Kim Jong-un is taking risks with millions of people, just as we always have, and NATO has, and Putin is doing. It's very hard for me to see that this problem does not begin with Donald Trump. That's what I'm saying.
Daniel Ellsberg is the whistleblower who leaked the Pentagon Papers and helped bring about an end to the Vietnam War. He, before that, had drafted nuclear war plans as a RAND consultant during the Kennedy era, and when he absconded with the Pentagon Papers, he also took nuclear war planning documents with him. His new book is about what they contained. It's called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And we will continue our conversation with Daniel Ellsberg when we return after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. Senate negotiators are working to hammer out a long-term budget deal that would avert tomorrow night's looming government shutdown. The deal was picking up steam even as Donald Trump vowed he'd be happy to trigger a government shutdown for his demands on immigration. The House last night passed a six-week stopgap spending bill largely along party lines. The measure appears increasingly likely to be rewritten by the Senate to include legislation implementing a broader budget deal, which would send it back to the House. On the House floor this morning, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said she will not support a spending bill unless Republican Speaker Paul Ryan commits to a vote on the Dreamers. Republican senators voted in committee to approve Donald Trump's nomination of a former coal industry lobbyist to serve as the second highest-ranking official at the Environmental Protection Agency. The Environment and Public Works Committee voted along party lines, 11 to 10, to send the nomination of Andrew Wheeler to the full Senate for a vote. Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley warned Wheeler would advance the EPA's anti-environment agenda.
He is another lobbyist for another industry, an administration that promised to drain the swamp, but instead we see a revolving door of lobbyists and D.C. bureaucrats taking appointments in the administration to new levels on issues directly related to their former clients. Plus, they've received waivers to allow them to proceed to avoid the ethics rules that bar former lobbyists from participating in any particular matter on which they lobbied in the past 2 years.
Before his nomination as EPA Deputy Administrator, Wheeler was a lobbyist whose clients included Murray Energy, one of the nation's largest coal mining companies. California's healthcare exchange says more than 50,000 new enrollees selected a covered California health plan during the final 3 days of open enrollment. Covered California said there were nearly 424,000 plan selections, a 3% increase over the last year. California officials have made robust efforts to encourage enrollment in Covered California, even as Donald Trump has been taking action to bring about the demise of the Obamacare program. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny, continued warm, highs in the mid-70s. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, patchy morning fog, then sunny and hazy, 69 to 75 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 10 on Letters and Politics. Join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
That's why we need a media that challenges the corporate power. When we cover war, we can't be brought to you by the weapons manufacturers. When we cover climate change, we can't be brought to you by the oil, gas, coal, nuclear companies. When we cover healthcare, we can't be brought to you by the insurance and the drug companies. We have to have a media that is a counterbalance to those in power. It's the only equalizing force.
That's why you listen to and support 94.1 FM, KPFA.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno. KPFA, KPFB,
in Berkeley, this Bobby, KPFA.
8:35 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. We're spending the hour with Daniel Ellsberg. You probably know him as the whistleblower who leaked the Pentagon Papers. Less known is that when he walked out of the Rand Corporation to Xerox those documents, he also took with him thousands of pages related to his work on nuclear war planning during the Kennedy era. When he came into that process, he was shown a plan that involved launching a U.S. nuclear strike on every city with a population of greater than 25,000 people in the Soviet Union and China. As far as he knew, he was the first person to ask how many people that would kill. His new book about those war plans and the process that was taking place inside the government at the time is called The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Back to the interview.
You make the point in the book that although the United States has not detonated a nuclear weapon in war since World War II, it has used its nuclear arsenal.
Yes.
On many occasions.
Many occasions. The idea that we have never used them since Nagasaki is simply mistaken. We've used our nuclear weapons repeatedly. The way you use a gun when you point it at someone's head in a confrontation, whether or not you pull the trigger. And in fact, most people in that situation think it's better if they get their way without pulling the trigger. They're not anxious to pull the trigger. But, and we have actually been successful on a number of those, and others not. The trigger hasn't been pulled since Nagasaki. But looking back on it, I think that has been a kind of miracle. And miracles do happen. The Berlin Wall came down. Nelson Mandela came into office without a violent revolution. No one predicted that that was possible, let alone that it was likely. But it did happen. We could, again, go through another 70 years without pulling the trigger. That could happen, the humans. I think it's very unlikely, and that we were extremely lucky that we've had these things. There have been many false alarms, many accidents, and there were occasions when different people under slightly different circumstances would have pulled the trigger on one side or the other. Not all of those would lead to nuclear winter, but some of them would. And that is a preparation and a risk that is unconscionable, but it turns out human, very human.
Another eye-opening point that you make in the book is that the power to launch a nuclear strike does not rest solely
yes.
with the head of state.
That's right. There's been so much concern that Donald Trump has the power to launch a doomsday machine or a lesser, or something that he imagined would remain limited, which he might imagine for Korea, delusionally. And they're wondering, does he really have this power? Yes. The answer is yes to that. Will he be stopped? Can he be stopped? Not really, not constitutionally, and not very likely, practically speaking, for any general or civilian to have persisted in rejecting a president's proposal here is almost unprecedented. I don't think of an instance, actually. People have said that's not a good idea or that's not the way to do it, not now, that sort of thing. But if the president persists day after day and said, no, I want this, he gets it. And if somebody were to reject it, like Mattis, or Mattis is supposedly the adult in the room who will restrain the president, who has the not reassuring nickname of Mad Dog. Nevertheless, would he resign? Would he refuse to carry it out? Nobody else has. I don't expect him to do it. So we have a situation then when the president can launch this. Yes, this president, like other presidents, does he look even more likely to do it in certain situations than others? Yes, you could say that. But I think others have been ready to do it. He's not the only one. In fact, we don't know for sure if he is ready, how he would react. But I do conclude that some of these threats in the past were bluffs, and others were not. And they were not called, and I think they would have been carried out. And whether Trump would or not, we don't know, but we also know that he is unpredictable. He not only makes a virtue of being unpredictable as a threatener of the madman theory, but he is unpredictable, even to people around him, and impulsive and thin-skinned and angry. And these are human characteristics. These are not far out, you know, extremist characteristics. They're representative of a large part of our population, actually, as is his racism and his misogyny and his nativism and so forth. Even rebuilding the doomsday machine was not a factor in the last election or any election before that, any election. It's not a political issue. Bernie Sanders did not press for that, for a change. He actually was open to it. But it wasn't an issue in his primary campaign against Hillary Clinton. Certainly it didn't arise in any of the debates this time or with Obama earlier or McCain. It hasn't been an issue. Climate hasn't been either, even though we are conscious of it. So I would hope that there would be a change to the delegitimation of threatening near extinction or threatening a billion people or 100 million people with nuclear weapons, which cannot be justified in terms of the deterrence, which I accepted when I was young in the 50s. I was well aware in 61 you didn't need to threaten 600 million or 500 million or 100 million to have deterrence. And so it was appalling to discover that that's what our Joint Chiefs were planning, appalling to me as a Cold Warrior and a former Marine.
So you come into advising the Kennedy administration, 1961. There's basically one plan for nuclear war.
That's the Eisenhower plan, yeah.
You're the first person to get the question in, well, how many people would it kill?
That's right. Not only, that's a good point. I drafted that question first for the Secretary of Defense, then it was picked up by the assistant to the Robert Comer, who was the Deputy National Assistant for Security, to Kennedy. How many people would be killed? I'm not aware of whether that question was ever put to the Joint Chiefs before. It may have been, but I still am not aware of it. As far as I know, the answer that I got to that has never been declassified. As you know, it's on page 2 and 3 of my book. It just occurred to me recently after the book was published. And by the way, I had assured Bloomsbury that I wasn't putting anything classified in this book, you know, for their lawyers, that they didn't want to get into a fight on that. It wasn't absolute. They were prepared to consider it, but they weren't happy at the thought of having to go through that. And so I said, no, not in the book. There's nothing classified. And then I realized recently, now that the book is out, wait a minute. I'm not aware that that chart I have of how many would be killed in the USSR and China alone from our first strike has ever been declassified. I put it by memory as a chart labeled top secret sensitive for the president's eyes only, meaning only the president is supposed to see that. I saw it because I drafted the question, so they showed it to me. But, and I'm sure that chart still exists somewhere, I don't think the government has ever officially given an estimate of how many people would be killed under various options. We do have a comment by Nixon that he was very appalled. This is in the National Security Archive in a meeting. He was appalled that the least number of people in the option he was offered to kill was 90 million people. And Kissinger said later, 80 million people to be only able, you know, at the least to kill 90 million people. It's the height of immorality. Well, that's very suggestive. It doesn't tell what the other options were. But of course, when I read that, when it came declassified many decades later, I thought, 1969? That's where we were after I had written, you know, withholding options against cities and against China and against Moscow and so forth. They're still killing 80 million people and 90 million people. And I learned, by the way, that they were still automatically going against China in the event that Washington was hit and we reacted by delegated authority, which Kennedy had renewed after Eisenhower delegated this. Okay, so I learned they're still hitting China automatically in 1968. So I hadn't had any effect on this. But as you know, in these first pages, I give this chart, and the answer comes down to 600 million people. It'll be the worst action in the history of the human species. And in reality, it would pretty much end the human species. It would end history. It would be the end. What Francis Fukuyama, you know, prematurely said at the end of the Cold War, the end of history. This would be the physical end of history.
So this seems like a perfectly reasonable conclusion to come to. And yet you're the only person of everyone you worked with on those plans who eventually came out with the determination to bring them to the public's attention and become a whistleblower.
That's true. I thought in 71, well, not in 71, but in 75, let's say, when by a miracle, a configuration of events that offends a sense of justice, as my judge put it, my charges and Tony Russo's charges were dropped.
That was a miracle,
a minor, a small miracle, and not to be, which I certainly hadn't foreseen. So I thought, okay, it by that time was clear it contributed to shortening the war in various ways. And I didn't go to prison. So, and I was able to make a living as a lecturer. It's probably the only whistleblower of whom that's true. Because others went to prison or, you know, they went into obscurity and whatnot. I was prosecuted. I'm the one who was then prosecuted. And that gave me a notoriety that made me able to make a living, even though my earlier professions, which involved clearances, let's say, were closed. And okay. So I thought, okay, that should encourage some other people to act likewise. I would think not a whole lot because I had been on trial facing 115 years of prison. And after all, it was kind of miraculous that I got away with it. So not a lot of people are going to volunteer for that, but some will when there's a question of millions of lives at stake, as there were in Iraq, for example, and of course with nuclear planning in general. It took 39 years for me to wait for somebody to do something very comparable, and that was Chelsea Manning, then Bradley Manning, who released a large amount of classified information, enough to make some real points.
So I guess my question is, like, why do you think more people who become involved with thinking about and planning for nuclear war don't react the way you did?
Well, I've just said how they react is a little hard to say in their minds.
Well,
as I just said, it took 40 years for somebody to turn up who acted the same way. I don't understand that totally, but it seems to be kind of human. And I don't understand it in terms, I can't explain it in terms of how unusual I am. I don't think I'm that unusual. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that I understand it. But what is clear is that the way we acted is very unusual. And what is the characteristic of that, I think, that keeps other people in line? I think it's fear of ostracism. I was just thinking about the difference between courage on the battlefield, which is very widespread in all cultures. On both sides of a conflict, you see courage routinely on both sides. Look at the Burns and Novick series on Vietnam. And what you're seeing is great courage on Americans and great courage on Viet Cong or North Vietnamese troops or South Vietnamese troops who lost great numbers over there. The courage is common. So how is it that courage in peacetime, or in wartime, by civilians, including some of these same people who were very courageous? And I've often had, I've puzzled with that, and I just thought of an answer to it. When you risk your body and your life on the battlefield, which people do, I've seen it now. As a former Marine, I walked with troops as a civilian in Vietnam, Vietnamese troops, South Vietnamese, and American. And I saw, as I say, routine courage all around me. What's the difference? They're risking their bodies, minds, genitals, everything. They're not risking ostracism. They're not risking being called traitors when they take these risks, or being called, and of course, by being courageous, they're assuring that they're not being called cowards. But put aside the physical aspect, they're not risking being disowned by their family. Whereas people who were in the movie, in deserters, some of them were supported by their families, or conscientious objectors, the people who inspired me by going to prison for nonviolent resistance to the war, many of them lost their family connections altogether. But the people who went to war, some of them realizing that this was a wrongful war, and some of them having the courage and the perspicacity to say, even in the film, I knew it was wrong and I didn't have the courage to resist. What they did have instead was the courage to risk their lives and their bodies. And I'm saying that, on the other hand, whistleblowers in the national security field are almost certain to be called threatening national security, traitors, non-American, and all that. And that is a risk that humans can't stand, being kicked out of membership or of respect or of status. And but there's a lot more whistleblowers in the corporate world, rightly, than there is in the national security world. And they aren't called traitors and they aren't prosecuted, but they lose their careers pretty much. They don't get hired.
It's been 45 years since you came public with the Pentagon Papers. Why did it take so long to go public with this part of your work?
Oh, I was going public all the time, but mm-hmm. I couldn't get a book published.
Oh, really?
That's why I have gotten arrested 87 times, give or take one or two, altogether. But about 50 of those, a lot of those are against interventions like Iraq, torture and things like that. But more than 50 or so of those arrests have been against nuclear weapons, as at the Livermore nuclear weapons facility. In fact, I'm sure I'll be arrested again on August 9th or 6th. Unfortunately, my wedding anniversary is the 8th, so we've missed a lot of those celebrating because I've been in jail or arresting on the 6th or the 9th, Nagasaki Day or Hiroshima Day. But that's an action, and I love being with the people who do that every year. There's always new ones, too, young people I'm glad to see. But the reason I do that is in part because it gets some local attention, this part or that part of the country, to the issue of nuclear war and why we are continuing to threaten extermination, not just to deter nuclear attack, but threatening extermination for a variety of purposes and on a vast scale. And it takes getting arrested to get any attention at all. That has not led to national attention at all. Almost none of those arrests got any, I'm not sure any one of them ever got national news or attention, anything. So a lot of people who haven't been arrested with me are not aware that I've been active on this subject for a long time. And I worked on the freeze movement, the bilateral nuclear weapons freeze. And there it did get some large-scale attention at that point. And it was rather appalling that when about 87% of the public was in favor of a freeze, that is, stopping, no more weapons on the U.S., or we've got enough, basically, which is, by the way, a realistic negotiating aim with North Korea. Stop where you are. No more H-bomb, no ICBM tests. Stop with what you have. Asking them to get rid of their deterrent weapons that they have now, their A-bomb weapons, is not realistic. That's what Trump is asking for, and that's a determination for failure in any kind of negotiation. But he's not going to get, he thinks that he would be crazy, Kim Jong-un, to give up the deterrent weapons he has. And that's not the kind of crazy he is. The kind he is crazy is, like us, seeking even more deterrence by getting ICBMs and H-bombs the way we have all along. And that's pretty dangerous. But not, as you say, without some logic, national logic of the kind we've used all this time. You asked, you know, why I haven't been doing anything. And the answer is, I haven't been doing anything that got me national attention until now, and thanks to Trump, you see, this book that is coming out is getting attention that I think would not have gotten 3 years ago, because he scared people the way Reagan scared a lot of people, and rightly so then. The world almost blew up then, thanks to the Soviets' reaction to Reagan's threats. And the world is less likely to blow up now as a result of Korea, but millions of people are at risk as a result of that. But in answer finally to your question, when the war ended in 75, I did try to publish I proposed a great part of this book, which was, you know, already I could do from memory without the documents, as now. And my publisher then said this would sell 1,400 copies. And I said, well, that's one for every member of Congress and a lot of the press and scholars. And okay, that's all right. She said, no, you don't understand. That means we wouldn't publish it. And that's been true ever since. This book was turned down by 17 publishers before Bloomsbury picked it up.
Wow.
So the public out there now has not been primed to be interested and what we're doing and what the risks are of nuclear war. But, you know, if I were proposing it now, right now, with Trump, I don't think I'd have trouble placing it with any of those 17 publishers. And, of course, it's sold more than 1,400 already, I'm glad to say. So it's Trump that is selling the book. Now, that's a silver lining to Trump, but obviously it's not compensated. I mean, I wish this were not the case, but it does mean that this book has the possibility of getting people's attention. And when they read it, they do recognize that it's talking about now, not just 50 years ago.
It certainly opened my eyes. Daniel Ellsberg, thank you so much for the book. Thank you so much for coming in to talk about it.
Thank you for the questions and for giving me the opportunity. Thank you.
Daniel Ellsberg is most famous for his role in releasing the Pentagon Papers that helped bring about an end to the Vietnam War. His new book is entitled The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. And it is based on his work doing war planning at the RAND Corporation and as an advisor to the Kennedy administration. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
And before we let you go, just a quick announcement. The Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz event that we had been planning to put on tonight has just been postponed. She had a case of the flu that unfortunately turned into a case of pneumonia. She expects to recover, but will not be back on the stage for some time. We've postponed the event to April 25th.
Full details on our website, kpfa.org.
You can also catch archives of our show there. You can listen to us live every weekday morning from 7 to 9 a.m. And you can get in touch by sending an email to upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to Lucy Kang, Kirsten Thomas, Julia Reichardt, Deboho Motaba, Kat Brooks, Salima Hamarani, Mitch Jezerich, and Eileen Alfandari. My name is Brian Edwards Tekert. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up at 9.
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending February 18th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. Mark Gomez discusses beyond crisis liberalism, exploring the possibilities for renewed economic progress and an end to economic exclusion in California. The talk takes place on Wednesday, February 14th at 12:30 p.m. at 2020 Addison Street in Berkeley. For details, call 510-644-2020. Praxis Peace Institute presents Richard Wolf and Harriet Frog, who discuss the economics and psychology of sexual harassment and assault. The talk takes place on Thursday, February 15th at 7 p.m. at Sonoma County Center's Andrews Hall, located at 276 East Napa Street in Sonoma. For details, call 707-939-2973. The restaurant opportunity, Center Bay Area, presents Reculture the Restaurant Industry Rally. You'll hear from guest speakers on racial equality and creating a harassment-free workspace. This event takes place on Tuesday, February 13th, from 11 o'clock a.m. to 1 o'clock p.m. at Splash Pad Park in Oakland. For details, call 510-761-7622. The community calendar is produced by members of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 4 weeks in advance to KPFA, Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.